Today on Canadian Politique One-on-One, I am thrilled that my Member of Parliament, Karen McCrimmon, Member of Parliament for Kanata-Carleton, is going to be on the pod. I sat down with Karen to talk, you know, about different issues locally, but also nationally. Everything from electoral reform came up to negativity in politics. It was a really great conversation, and I enjoyed immensely having her on the show. Just by way of background, she had a 31-year military career. She retired as a lieutenant colonel in the Canadian Forces. She was actually the first female navigator and the first woman to command a Canadian Forces Air Force squadron. She got involved in politics in 2008. 2011, she ran in what was then Carleton, Mississippi Mills. Now it's Kanata-Carleton. She didn't win that time, but she won by 51% of the vote in 2015. She's a nominated candidate this time. And she also ran for the Liberal Party leadership in 2013 as well. She's a really great lady. She is phenomenally committed to this community. Her and I have butted heads, but I tell you, there's nobody else I'd rather have on my side than this wonderful lady. And so I hope you enjoy the chat. I did. Karen, looking forward to you coming back. I am very pleased today to be here for Canadian Politique One-on-One with my local MP, Karen McCrimmon. Hello.
Hello, Cameron.
Welcome to the pod.
Happy to be here.
You are in. You are following in good stead. Minister Philpott has been in that seat. Nate Erskine-Smith, somewhat in that seat. He called in from Toronto. Many other good folks have been there, but I'm really delighted that you're here. And I'm delighted that you took time to be on the pod.
No, I'm really happy. I really appreciate the work you do.
Oh.
And to get this message out there and make it accessible to more people, it's really important.
You know, I know I can, sometimes you and I talk, I go for the jugular, but this isn't going to be that kind of interview that time. Yeah, phew. But so first of all, I also meant to say, Karen, you were just appointed Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Public Safety. Previously to that, you were Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Transport. And previous to that, Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Veterans Affairs. So congratulations. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
And I'm pleased to hear that. But before we get to that piece, tell us about you, because you have a pretty remarkable story. You were the first female to command a squadron in the Canadian Forces. You served in Afghanistan. You retired as a lieutenant colonel.
Right.
Tell us just, you know, quickly about your journey from there to where you are right now.
Yeah. And life is funny, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't always happen the way you think it's going to happen or even the way that you set it up to happen.
Yeah.
And I think my whole life has been like that. I didn't plan on joining the military. I joined the reserve, or the cadets was where I started, on a dare from my brother. So he dared me. I said, sure as heck did. And then from there, I did a degree, and that's how I funded my university, was being as a member of the reserves part-time. And I studied French, German, and Russian. And so I was kind of heading towards the Foreign Service.
Yep.
But the summer I graduated, they had just laid off 250 Foreign Service officers.
Oh, really?
So I thought to myself, well, okay, I can stay on this path, or I can also join the military, because I felt very comfortable.
Yep.
I could function in that environment and do a good job. I said, well, why not? And they had just opened the flying trades to women.
Okay.
So I thought, oh, this should be a real adventure.
Yep.
I should go and try this. And so I did. And it ended up being, and then the first 5 years as an Army clerk, that's how I got started. Because in 1975, okay, yeah, you can figure out how old I am.
29 forever.
That was the only job I could do, was
as
administration
clerk
in the Army. So, and then, you know, years later when I joined the Air Force, and the world opened.
So when you joined the Air Force, sorry to cut you off, but when you joined the Air Force, so they just opened it to women, how, I'm just curious, lots of sexism there? I mean, it was tough. Really bad?
It was tough.
Really bad.
It really was.
Yeah.
Because some people thought that if they made life really miserable for us, that we would all leave. And they did succeed. And what we learned over time is that you need that base number of people. Where you had units that had three or more women, they survived and they thrived.
Yeah.
If we sent just a single woman to a unit, none of them survived.
Is that right?
Right.
How many were in yours? So three, then, at least.
I had 4 or 5 at one time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we were all pretty lucky because we had each other to rely on. And when, you know, things got tough, we could express our frustration to each other and then go back and get back to work and, you know, be an important and integral member of that unit. But it was hard.
So how does it go in the military to get to where you were? How did you kind of progress then through that?
Yeah, well, you start out as a lieutenant, as I was a navigator. And you start, you do a tour. And I did tactical airlift, which is like aerial delivery, putting parachutes, people and equipment out of the back of the airplane.
And oh, my gosh.
So I did that as a tour, and then I switched over to another aircraft and did air-to-air refueling, which is the, well, when we refuel our fighter jets in the air.
So which is we terrifying were, looking.
Which was not. It was actually fascinating work. It was great. And so that was my second tour. My third tour was on the same squadron, but with an increase in rank.
Right.
So the first two tours are as a captain.
Yep.
You do well, then you can get promoted to major, and then you move into a squadron in a supervisory role.
Okay.
And then it depends how you do there, whether you get sent off to staff college or something like that to prepare you for being a higher rank.
So how many in a squadron? Just curious. So when you commanded the squadron, you commanded them during Afghanistan as well.
Well, no. In Afghanistan, I was a NATO staff officer.
Oh, really?
I actually planned all the airlift for all the NATO air assets operating in Afghanistan at that time.
All the different countries?
Other than the United States.
Okay.
They had their own command and control. But we actually, because I was posted to the NATO headquarters at that time, we convinced the other countries to give this NATO air component headquarters that was moving into Afghanistan to give us operational control of their airlift assets.
Oh my gosh.
It was the first time in NATO that had ever happened.
So normally everybody just kind of silos it themselves.
That's right. NATO will give out the taskings.
Yeah.
And you nations, you do it all yourself. So they decide. So this time it was, give us control of your assets and let us schedule them and control it and manage it and keep it safe and share it. So in the past, each country had their own silo and they did their own work.
Yeah.
But there was often a lot of waste.
Yeah, no kidding.
So what we wanted,
repetition.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so what we wanted to do, and the countries agreed. So that was pretty monumental for us.
So then you retired after Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would have been
2006.
I was going to say 2005, 2006. And then you started this journey.
Yeah.
For this journey that got you elected in 2015,
mm-hmm.
which was tough. I, you know, full disclosure, folks, I served on Karen's board and it was a tough riding. Kanata Carlton, before that was known as Carlton Mississippi Mills, held by the Conservatives for a number of years. You're really the first liberal in a generation to take that seat.
Yes.
I mean, that's the truth.
It was only liberal once before when the Conservative Party was split.
That's right. And now you went in when you ran in 2011.
Right.
It was around 28% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
Or sorry, 26%. And then when you won in 2015, it was 51%.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, due in part, obviously, to the Prime Minister and the campaign that was run, due in part to you, but also thank you very much for those judicial boundary reviews, because it made Kanata more of an urban riding, and it doesn't take away from the rural aspects because we do have a good element of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly made it a more friendly riding from a liberal perspective, I would think.
I think it's almost 800 square kilometers.
That's right.
That our riding is. And it's, to me, I think it's the best of both worlds. We have this suburban core, and it's also where our Canada's high-tech hub is, really.
Yep. Yep.
Nobody else compares. There are some other areas that do more research and have more universities. But when it actually comes to exporting, when it comes to producing GDP, Canada, it leads in this country.
From our little park kind of thing. You know,
That's right.
We drive, because most people don't know what goes on in there. And I've said that to a few folks. You know, you drive down March Road, you see the banners on there, but I often think there's an open door Ottawa idea. Get them into the tech park so we can find out what's going on. But there are some great companies. There's Nordion, there is
Mitel,
all sorts of different things.
There's also a lot of really brilliant startups. And really, when we talk about technology and how it's changing, everything from artificial intelligence to cybersecurity to communications to financial tech, it's clean tech even. It's all there. And it's really almost like an ecosystem that they rely on each other. And sometimes they're in competition with each other. And sometimes they collaborate or cooperate in order to push a certain product or a way of approaching business. Sometimes they work together. It's absolutely remarkable.
I want to talk some local issues, some national, and then something broader. But first, so let's talk a couple of things with Kanata. LRT.
Yes.
So you successfully got us the environmental assessment that needed to be done. You were one of you pushed the federal government to do that, which is fantastic. How do we, I guess I'm asking this because of your previous experience as the PS to transport. So some municipalities, and Toronto comes to mind, or I think Calgary or what have you, when they get their funding allotment from the federal government for transport, oftentimes their split is not one third, one third, one third. It'll be like an 80-20 split, or sometimes 100% or what have you. I know I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but you know, is there a way that you could see that the federal government, you know, could potentially maybe move us up the line and possibly say to Ottawa, you know what, we recognize you've got 900,000 people in the community. That tax base is a lot lower than writ large. We'll be prepared to fund a little bit more and maybe move up the timeline. Could you foresee that? Is it something that you're working on? That kind of question, I guess, I'm just throwing out there.
No, it's a really good question because I really believe we need LRT in Kanata. And it's funny, if you drive in through Kanata at rush hour, either rush hour, there are an equal number of cars leaving as coming.
That's right.
So we would be using this LRT continuously,
correct,
not just in one direction.
Yeah.
So this has been my argument all along. You need partners.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we've tried to, the message that the federal government has put out there. You need municipal partners, you need provincial partners, and we're willing. We've signaled already by investing the money to do the environmental assessment. This is something that we believe in.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a challenge. But right now, I think we need the same signal from the provincial government.
Yeah. No, right? I agree.
We need that signal from them that this is something that they're interested in doing.
Yeah.
Now, there was a commitment to finish phase two.
Yep.
And I hope we follow through on that commitment.
Yep.
But there was no commitment for any follow-on phases.
Yeah.
So we're having those discussions. We think it's really important. And if we look at the kind of economy that we're trying to build here in Ottawa and attract the young people that we act, the high-tech young people that we need.
Yep.
It's so important. So those discussions are ongoing.
My own personal hope is at some point when we look at LRT, I hope that we're looking at the surrounding track. I mean, there's so many, there's Elmont, Carleton Place, Arnprior, these bedroom communities out there, that it would be fantastic if eventually we could get to this point where it's all interconnected, because Canada is so often, it's the size of our geography. We're so often behind the eight ball, really, in terms of advancing our transportation capabilities. And I just, everybody wants LRT to Canada. So I thank you for what you're doing, because I know it's not easy. And especially when you've got new funding partners or not at the table in this government as well. So, question for you. So let's talk a little bit about, before we move into your parliamentary secretary responsibilities, thing you're most proud of in the last term that you've been elected in Kanata that you've been able to bring to the ward or done for the ward. Something, just one, and it doesn't have to be anything fancy, but just something.
No, it's the LRT.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is that environmental assessment. That really puts us in a good place.
Yeah.
And if we have the right funding partners, we're ready to go.
Yeah.
And we can actually demonstrate the route from Moody into Kanata. It's very straightforward.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the cost of that particular segment is actually, it's relatively reasonable.
Yeah, because I know it was like, people were saying it was upwards of $1 billion or what have you, but it's not.
No. So, because it's all on grade.
Right.
All right?
Yeah.
We don't cross major highways. We don't you know, the things that drive up the costs.
Yeah.
So we're actually to have that out there and have an idea of what that cost would be.
Yep.
That puts us in a good position, which means the rest phase two won't be finished until 2023, yep. 2024.
Yeah.
We might be in the right place at the yep. right time.
Yeah.
And our homework is done. So for me, that's my number one, to be able to get out there. And that gives me the power to argue.
Yeah.
Okay. To
yeah.
say, hey, look at this.
Yeah.
This is, would be relatively easy to do.
Gives you the drum to bang.
And look yeah. at what we can get for ridership.
Yeah.
In both directions.
That's right.
With that amount of money.
Yeah.
So I think that would be the number one. But I also, I'm happy to see the resurgence of the tech segment in Canada.
Yeah, because it took a hit.
It did take a hit. We are back
yeah.
to pre-recession and pre dot-com bust kind of era. We are back
yep.
at that kind of level
yep.
right now. And I mean, I go out and visit so many of the tech companies, and anybody who calls me, you call me, I'll come and visit.
Case and, in point, you know, you're here.
And I just love it when you find out the kind of technology that's being developed in Canada.
Yeah.
And we've done some good work actually connecting them to each other.
That's good.
And I do some lobbying. He says, you have to come. So
yeah.
I'm trying to persuade some of my colleagues to come out and see, because they don't know. It's kind of, you're right. It's hidden.
It is.
People
and even
don't
for
know
people that
it.
Live there.
No.
I mean, to be honest, I mean, I didn't know for the longest time that it was the largest tech park. And I think we are Silicon Valley North up mm-hmm. there. You know, really, it's not, I'm not being facetious, folks. Mm-hmm. We really yeah. are. But I don't think we get the due that we deserve. And mm-hmm. I think that just is Canadian modesty.
I think it is too.
You know?
Well, we don't want to toot our own horn. No. Yeah, we need to toot our own
right
horn.
Right now, especially
yeah,
with due respect to our friends in the United States, we now need to toot our own horn yeah. because there's people in the United States in the environment that they're in right now, without putting anybody on the spot, that are looking to Canada as maybe a friendlier outpost and a friendly place to invest. And we know our investment numbers are doing well.
Yeah.
And our job numbers are the lowest, I think, in the last 40 years. You know, we are doing very, very well. So it's not a bad story for us to be telling.
No. And like I said, when we were talking about the LRT, you need people who are willing to engage in partnerships.
Correct. Yeah.
That's how you build your economy.
Yeah.
You know, that's how you build that particular segment. And
yeah.
the world is looking at it and say, hey, they're a pretty smart bunch in Canada, and they seem to get along together.
Yeah.
And they seem to be pretty open and welcoming.
Yep.
It looks like a decent place to live, so why not? And that's exactly it. We are open for business. We're serious about this. But we also want to recognize that we need help from other people. We need to have people say, yes, I want to engage with Canada.
Yep.
Yes, I think this is some place that is worth investing in and or immigrating to. It matters. And that kind of example that we're setting to the rest of the world's kind of looking at us, look at Canada. They kind of seem to got it figured out. Why is that?
So let's talk about that. So this goes to your responsibilities in terms of public safety, emergency preparedness.
Mm-hmm.
Conservative rhetoric tells us, And I got to be honest, Karen, you know, I can be pretty vicious. And I have to say that some of the viciousness, though, that's come out of the Conservatives vis-a-vis what is going on at the border in particular, but generally this mantra that they seem to be adopting that is, you know, it is... I hate to use this term white supremacist, but it has its roots in some of these areas. Tell us a story about what is really going on at the border, because what we hear is it's unsafe. These people coming in are criminals. They are here to bilk the society and tear it down from the inside, and the government doesn't have a handle on it. Obviously, I know that's not true. What would you say? Your PS to the Minister of Public Safety. Tell us what you would say.
I don't like this kind of rhetoric. I really, and I don't think Canadians like it either.
Yep.
You know, this is an issue that needs to be dealt with deliberately, thoughtfully, across the entire government, and that's exactly what's happening. If you look back 40 years ago when, you know, coming out of Southeast Asia, the boat people,
yep.
We took 60,000 of these refugees and at a time when Canada was like under 24 million people. Yep.
That was Joe Clark that did that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's not a crisis.
Yep.
We've done it before. We took 25,000 people from Syria a year ago, and that's going well. It's an issue that needs to be dealt with, but it doesn't need to have this fear mongering. And I say, you know what, Canadians, we'll rise to the challenge.
Yep.
We've got the right kind of thinking, the right kind of resources, the right kind of people dealing with this question. Well, we'll deal with it, but it's certainly not a crisis that people need to be in an uproar about. And that's what they want to create is
and
that
they have.
Uproar.
I mean, I think, we've seen some of the polls that have come out and they really have. And I think we heard on the pod a couple of weeks ago that I think it's less than 1%, because one of our co-hosts writes for The Conversation Canada, and she said it's less than 1% of Canadians, of refugees that are coming into Canada, or asylum seekers, who actually have a criminal record or criminal intent. I mean, I find it really galling that we're even having this conversation in 2018, frankly. I mean, I don't feel unsafe in my community. And I don't know if from your perspective, like, is it a fear of difference, or is there, you know, or can, you know, some people that maybe don't have that fear of difference, are they right to think, you know, maybe we're not doing everything the way we should be doing?
Mm-hmm. I think there's been a lot of change in our societies, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if you look at even since the recession, and people lost jobs.
Yeah.
People, their hope for the future changed because of all of this turbulence. So it makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Right?
And they look for somebody to blame.
And they're already fearful.
Yeah.
They're fearful of the future. They're fearful for their children in that. Will they actually have the same kind of opportunity I did? So yeah. I think a lot of that comes from a position of fear.
Yeah.
Because and insecurity, not being confident that especially their children are going to have the same opportunity, the same kind of standard of living and quality of life.
So how do you push back against the fear? Like, because we can say education. But what, you know, like, what is it? Like, what, because what we talk about the inclusiveness. We talk about the value that multiculturalism bring and being a welcome port in a storm. Mm-hmm. Really, that's who we are. But on the different side of the coin are these individuals who we've spoken about, it's almost like they get more traction with what they're saying. We've seen it with Maxime Bernier. We've seen it with kind of what the debate going on in the Conservative Party now. Why do they get so much more traction? And how do we push back against that narrative of fear in a way that doesn't sound like, all right, well, we're just sloughing it off?
Well,
and it's a tough question.
I know, and there's no easy answer. But for me, I think about it that people are much easier to control when they're fearful, when they're afraid.
Yep.
They can be led to do certain things when they're afraid. And I think we're trying to message out there, hey, we understand that.
Yep.
We know that, you know, this turbulence, this insecurity is out there. But look at the actually statistics. Look at the facts.
Yep.
And the immigrants and refugees that have come to this country, so many of them turn around. They create jobs.
Well,
they pay us back. We're paid back in short order.
That's right.
So, yes, every
like
now
that and Syrian couple,
yes.
The Peace Chocolates is a great example. No. Bombed, their facility was bombed in Syria. They came over here as refugees. They opened a chocolate factory, excellent chocolate, called Peace Chocolates. We brought them in. They come here. They start contributing. They're job creators. It's right there. That is the Canadian story. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really... It is. And I feel like those individuals get shunted aside in this chase for headlines and, like you say, control of people's worst instincts.
Yeah. And when you talk about the difference, and we talked about the people from Southeast Asia 40 years ago, look at them now.
Yeah.
There are doctors and our anesthesiologists and our dentists and our teachers and, you know, and so... We just have to say, don't be afraid.
Yeah.
Trust us that these people who will come to Canada, they will make Canada better.
And trust the record that's been laid.
That, yes, we have the statistics that actually prove that. We're richer as a country. We're more prosperous as a country because we've welcomed so many people from around the world.
Amen. Now, handgun ban.
Mm-hmm.
That's hot in the news. Now, the last time we tried this under Prime Minister Chrétien and Martin after that, it wasn't specific, obviously, to handguns. It was a long gun registry. But I know that there's always this, liberals hate rural folks. They hate gun owners. They hate all these folks. First of all, is it the government is actively considering a handgun ban? What, how would that work in practice? And number two, how effective would it be? Because I've heard some folks in the police, I think the Toronto Police Association, saying, well, no, it won't work at all. Then others saying, well, but it just might. But then we've got the export coming or the import coming in of guns from the United States. So how would it look?
Yeah, this this particular issue of looking into this is going to Minister Blair.
Yeah.
Okay. You don't get a more credible person to be able to talk about this issue than Bill Blair.
Yeah.
So he's been tasked by the Prime Minister to look into it and to look into all those things that you just mentioned. What's the efficacy going to be? What's the impact going to be on our police forces? What's the where are the impacts going to be? How many people will this influence? Where do firearms come from in Canada? So he's the one who is actually going to look into all those things that you just mentioned. There has not been any decision made. And the Prime Minister is counting on Minister Blair's knowledge to actually come up with a recommendation. So I know that he's going to be out talking to people. He will be out consulting. We know this is a challenging issue. It's true. But I think it's important to have this conversation. And, you know, and it's not just, that's only one part of it.
Right.
Right. That's a very specific segment. But if we're going to do something about the reduction of violence in our communities, prevention of violence in our community, it's much more than that. Yeah. That's only one piece of the
puzzle. It's the social determinants. And you are working on it right now. Like, this government has done a fantastic job, to be honest, you know, whether it's gender equity, you know, whether it's pursuing, you know, strategies along innovation that brings in LGBTQ plus folks or Indigenous Canadians on the reconciliation and trying to address, you know, poverty violence,
reduction.
Shelter. Yeah, all of these different pieces.
No, that's right. And affordable housing.
Yeah.
Well, like we've known that if you want to talk about gang violence specifically, that is, again, it's rooted in instability.
Yeah.
It's rooted in a hopelessness that you'll actually be able to create a better life. And it's rooted in a lot of the gang violence about the profits from drugs.
Yeah.
So we need to have a look at all those things and not think that just one little change is going to make the difference. You really need a comprehensive plan to address this issue.
Yeah. I mean, H.L. Mencken once said that for every complex problem, there's a neat, simple solution that's always wrong. Mm-hmm. And if we just focus on the one, you're absolutely right. Okay, last quick question, and then we're going to get into very quickly the negativity in politics. But last quick question, Florence is coming. Hurricane Florence is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Emergency preparedness is part of your portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
I hope, you know, knock on wood, are not going to be hit obviously as hard as those in the Carolinas or on the East Coast of the United States. But climate change is changing the nature of the threats against us. Are we safer than we were, or are we less safe than we should be because provinces and the federal governments before this one have not made the necessary investments? Are we in a good shape? Are the investments that are being made into infrastructure funding, into programs, you know, on climate change mitigation or just emergency preparedness generally taking into account like the stretch of weather that we're going to be experiencing? Because it has gotten worse even in the last 4 years. It's been terrible. So are we better off in that sense?
I think it's most Canadians now, from the latest statistics I've seen, believe that the climate change is happening and it's man-made.
Yeah.
That is a huge step Yeah. We weren't there.
No.
Like 4 years ago.
No, but some people still aren't.
Some people still aren't. So to have most Canadians on side with that, that's really important for us. We also have to talk about the pollution and the costs associated with that pollution.
Yeah.
And that's why if you talk about there's a human cost to pollution, and it's health costs. It's deaths in these kind of emergency situation.
Extreme weather.
There's economic costs, insurance costs, all of this. So now this is how we have to look at this again. Yeah. As a whole, and I think sometimes what makes it hard to be a liberal is that we try and look at the big picture.
Yes, I know.
Right? When people want a quick sound bite and an easy answer, well, no, we don't have it.
Yeah.
Because we see that it's a bigger problem. But right now, having like the funds that are going out there for green infrastructure and how we're going to look after our coastlines better? How are we going to improve our reaction times when it comes to these kind of emergencies? That discussion is ongoing. And I think in the past, there wasn't the energy there behind that. It was kind of, oh, yeah, yeah. But I'll tell you what, that energy is there now, that commitment. Emergency management, we know we need to get better at it. But again, comes back to the same thing. One level of government can't do it. One agency can't do it.
Yeah.
And if you're not talking, and sometimes we disagree with the provinces, but we still need to talk to them.
Yeah, no dialogue.
No, if you're not talking to them, nothing's going to happen.
That's right.
So, I mean, sometimes we might not get the kind of reception or reaction that we're hoping for, but we just keep going back. Let's have this discussion. Because we need to all work together if something like this was to come our way. So those, I think there's a recognition that that discussion has to happen. And the federal government is committed to helping provinces. And I think we're in a better place than we were before, but there's still an awful lot of work to do.
Yeah, because we were underfunding our infrastructure for years. Even the Tories' much-vaunted economic action plan was a lot of sign makers. They did very well. So, okay, last topic before we let you go, and you're a busy lady, so I got to put it out there. So Karen knows me as I can be. She tells me that I need to rein it in quite often because I can be pretty nasty. I know you are not a fan of negative politics. So I want to approach this not from me per se, but more generally. Selena, I can never pronounce her last name. Your colleague.
Chavez.
She actually stepped back from being a parliamentary secretary because of the vitriol that she has experienced, racism, frankly. I mean, we've seen it in the House from members opposite. How is it as a woman in politics? And I truly mean this. My mom was a single mom, you know, and she's kind of that get up and go, and she's no BS. She doesn't want any special treatment, but she's kind of like, screw it. You know, we're moving forward, but she's sensitive to the realities that go around. You're on a bigger stage in the community. We know what happened previously with the last MPP there. You know, how has that informed your role as our member of parliament? But even beyond that, before that, in your previous career, in your previous life in the military, like that is a negative environment. How do you rise above it and how do you move forward from it?
Yeah, I that's a very good question. And I think that one of my major roles is to be a leader in such a way that I set an example for how it should be done.
Yeah.
So, so I have a bit of a thick skin. It can be penetrated, but I kind of look at this, where is this coming from?
Yeah.
And often it goes back to the same thing. It's fear.
Yeah.
They're afraid.
Yeah.
And so, so they lash out and they try and hurt you and stuff. So I try and forgive as much as I can, but it's interesting. Our spouses, Ashley.
They wear it.
Oh, man. Yeah. They're not happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, so that's hard on a family. My children see it too.
Yeah.
Right. Mom, do you see what they said? Well, that's not true. You've never, you know. So its effect on me, I can let that kind of like water off a duck's back. But when it upsets my family, that I really take to heart. And I think we've seen more and more of that now.
But why? Like, why, you know, where is this divide coming from? It can't just be leaking in from the United States. Or maybe it is, because sometimes I feel like we adopt the worst qualities of our southern neighbors at a quicker rate than they do. Like, they, you know, it seemed like more of an evolution, whereas here it's really been in the last, I would say, decade that this has really ramped up the way it has. Like, this ugliness in politics. And I, you know, full disclosure, you know this, I have no trouble going for the jugular. I have to learn to do it less on a personal basis and more on a policy, because I remember hearing, I think it was Patrick Moynihan in the States saying something once about how never question somebody's motives, because you don't know what the motives are. You can go after them on policy, but don't go after them as a person. Or a, so you're quite right. But where did this, like, how did this rot set into our system where we've got people that are actively trying to divide and conquer? And I mean, I think it's fair to say there's trolls on Twitter. I've been accused of that myself sometimes. But like, how did this happen?
Well, I do believe.
And how do we end it?
I do believe it was a direct import from the Republican Party in the United States. Yeah. And it was directly imported in Canada. And that was one of the reasons why I decided to get involved in politics. It frightened me because we had always managed to have good discussions.
That's right.
We could disagree. I'm sorry, I don't. But there wasn't this vitriol that I saw creeping in. And I thought, okay, I don't want to wake up someday and say I woulda, coulda, shoulda.
That's right.
And so I stepped in to get involved. Now, I think there's some things about our politics that we do need to change. Did you know back in the 90s, and I don't know when it changed, I should go look this up, all the MPs would take a break at lunch hour and go have lunch together.
Up in the parliamentary dining room.
Up in the dining room.
Yeah.
They would sit down and at the same table, you'd have NDP and conservatives and liberals, and they would all sit. And that's changed.
Yeah.
We don't have lunch together anymore. We have lunch in our lobbies.
That's right.
There's the opposition lobby and there's the government. So there's very, very little opportunity for us to engage with each other other than in question period.
Well, yeah.
And that's a question period. The demeanor in question period has just, it's embarrassing.
It really is embarrassing.
And I've had people in question period kind of attack my motives or attack me and then later say to me, well, you know, it's just all political theater. I said, no, sorry,
it's not.
That doesn't sit with me.
No.
So if it's not something you're going to say to my face, then you ought not to be saying it in question period. That's just not acceptable. So how do we dial
well,
this
back?
Well,
that's the question, because it just get the dial, we'd love to dial it back, but the dial gets cranked up every day. Mm-hmm. And I mean, whether it's, and I don't mean to just finger the Tories on this one, but you know, I've seen what they write on there, you know, or Scheer will say, you know, everybody's a liar. We know for a fact, based on the Canadian Press article that was done and some independent journalism, that the Tories are making up a lot of facts as they go along, which is feeding into that. Mm-hmm. There is an ugliness. I mean, we remember Stefan Zioen and the cartoons, the caricatures that the Tories put up with them. I hate to just find it on one party because we share the blame in 2006, you know, soldiers on our streets, you know, the way we went after Stephen Harper. But I just don't know what the solution is to dial it back. And if this is the way it's going to go, people like you aren't going to want to continue to be involved in politics. And why would you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then what are we left with? 338 Pierre Polivers? Like, honestly, and I'm not being flippant. You know, I mean that.
No, there isn't any easy answer here. How do you dial back the partisanship once it's there? One of the ways, and I think that we do need electoral reform.
Yeah.
I know
so
that
what happened
we tried to do it within the parliamentary system.
Yeah.
And there's just too much partisanship and nobody's willing to compromise.
Yeah.
And actually come up with a system that they could live with. And I tell people that, you know, it's not I agree or disagree. There's a third option. It's the third option is, well, it's not my first choice, but I could probably live with it.
That's right.
It's, you know, and so we need more of that.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't exist in the parliamentary system. In Canada, I did, in my householder, I did a survey with questions about the nature of the electoral system that Canadians want. And it came back, we got about 1,000, almost 1,000 replies sent
there. That's pretty good.
Which is pretty good. And they said, They want a system that actually rewards cooperation and collaboration.
And that's the ranked ballots. I'm in favor of ranked ballots. Yeah. That's I've always been.
And I used to be in favor of proportional representation. But then the problem with that is that it just reinforces and empowers political parties.
Yeah. It's a chosen list.
Which there's ways around that, but it still does increase the power of political parties. And yeah. I think we need to lessen the power of political parties, make room for independence. And I think that's and the other thing is that people came back to me. They said, nope, we want one riding, one MP. We don't want shared riding. Yeah. We don't want shared MPs. We want less power in political parties. We want more collaboration. We want that to be rewarded. We want less extremism. And you're right. That leads towards a ranked ballot. And so I'm like, we couldn't make it work because it's really hard without having more conversations with Canadians about this.
Yeah.
And I think we need to do even more consultations than we've done in the past. But I think it is the key to reducing some of that hyper-partisanship that we've seen right now.
Yeah, if everybody was somebody's second, third, fourth choice, it always works better that way because then you have to appeal to everybody. And right now, that's just not out there.
It would be tougher on the government to try and get legislation through and stuff like that. But I think it would it's probably one of the things we need in order to improve the current situation.
Well, my friend, I hope you will come back because I could sit here and talk to you all day. I know we're on a time limit, but I have to say thank you for what you're doing. I know it was a long road to get there because 2011 and then you won in 2015 and you're going to run again in 2019.
I am.
You're already nominated.
I am the nominated candidate for Kanata Carlton.
And you feel good about it, obviously.
I was knocking on doors this summer.
Were you?
Oh, yeah. People are content,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We have some issues we need to work on, but generally the economy is doing well.
Yeah.
Kanata is doing well. So, yeah, that makes me happy when I can get out there and talk to people.
Well, my friend, I truly, truly appreciate you being here. And I can't wait till you come back. Again, congratulations on your appointment as Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Public Safety and Emergency Preparedness. Thank you. You're my MP, and I value you greatly and the work you do. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Cameron, for the invitation, and thank you for the work that you do as well.
Even when I can be a little harsh. All right. Thanks, Karen.
All right. Thanks.
And that's Canadian Politique One-on-One. Thanks again to my guests, Karen McCrimmon, Leanne, Mike, and me. We'll be back next week to talk about what is going on in our world if Trump has not pressed the nuclear button by the time that happens. At any rate, we will see you next week. Thanks.